Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. This is the show where we affirm the power and the pleasure of dreams, coincidence, and imagination. Very happy to have a wonderful guest today who's a friend of this show and has been with us before. His name is Rizwan Burke, if his friends call him Riz, and he is a friend. He's many things, including prolific as an author, as an entrepreneur, as a designer of role-playing video games, as somebody who studies the nature of reality, and has been at the forefront of those putting forward the simulation hypothesis, which suggests that maybe, just maybe, we're all living in some kind of super gigantic, califragilistic video game. His new book is Wisdom of a Yogi, Lessons for Modern Seekers from Autobiography of a Yogi, and there's a rich menu in those words. In other words, he's taken the classic work of popular yoga, Paramahansa Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi, which has influenced so many and really made yoga a popular cause in intellectual terms in the West. He's taken that classic book and he's extracted in a very lucid and exciting way lessons for us, what we can learn from it as seekers in on the roads of ordinary life. Welcome, Riz.
Thanks, Robert. It's great to be back with you.
I have to start with your name, Rizwan. You know, Rizwan is, as I understand it, one of the guardians of paradise in Muslim tradition. You know, he tries to keep out the evil one, Iblis. He tries to guard paradise. So here is a fellow with the name of a Muslim guardian of paradise who's currently number 6 in the Hindu theology section at Amazon.com. I mean, bravo. This is really quite an achievement. So tell us how you come from your family background and family orientation to giving us a very effective popular treatment of one of the great books of, quote, Hindu, unquote, philosophy.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, as you mentioned, I have a Muslim name because I grew up in a Muslim family. I was born in Pakistan. You know, while I was growing up, I was always encouraged, you know, to not read those Hindu traditions, if you will, because there's a bit of friction between the two. And, you know, as I graduated from MIT and started my first company, I used to think of it as I was living a double life. Like during the day, I was in the business world. I was managing people. I was meeting venture capitalists, raising money, doing all of the things that an entrepreneur would do. And then in the evening and on the weekends, I'd be jetting away, you know, to different types of workshops, including yours, Robert, learning shamanic dream work from you, as well as, you know, I went down to the Monroe Institute and all these different places. And also I learned to explore different states of consciousness using different types of meditation, which of course comes, you know, from the Hindu and Buddhist traditions primarily is you know, where I studied. And so it was a bit unusual for me to write this book. What happened was that I had gone through some health issues a few years earlier, and because of that, I ended up refocusing my career, which had been as an entrepreneur and an investor, on my writing, and I had written this book about the simulation hypothesis and how, you know, modern ideas of video games actually meshed pretty well with the ancient religious ideas, particularly in the Buddhist and Hindu traditions of Maya and illusion. And I also reread, as I do every few years, Autobiography of a Yogi, which has been an inspiration for me. And I ended up writing a few blog posts about that book. And I never intended to write a book about Yogananda or about lessons that we might get from his book in the modern world. But one day, out of the blue, I got an invitation from HarperCollins India on the 75th anniversary of the publishing of Autobiography of Yogi, which was published in 1946. And they said, well, we'd like to write a book about lessons that people have learned from Yogananda's classic, which has been read by millions of people, was, you know, a favorite of Steve Jobs. His biographer said it was the only book on his iPad. And, you know, Steve Jobs gave it away at his funeral in a little wooden box, as we learned from the CEO of Salesforce.com. When he took the box home, he opened it, and it was a copy of Autobiography of the Yogi. And at first, I was a little surprised. I was like, are you sure you want me to write this book? First of all, I'm not even Hindu. I'm certainly not Swami Rizwan. And, you know, I'm an entrepreneur and an investor. And, yes, I've written about spiritual topics, but mostly about bridging the gap with the modern world. And they said, that's exactly what we want. We want you to use modern analogies of computers, social media, video game, and we want this to be written not only for those who may already have read Yogananda's book long ago, but also for those who may not have and are looking to apply some of the ancient wisdom of yoga into the modern world. And so, you know, I had one of those electric feelings, what I like to call a clue, that, okay, this was the right thing to do. It was as if the universe had put a task out for me. And sometimes the universe, this is one of the lessons in the book, sometimes the universe gives you a task that you may or may not feel qualified to do, but it is your task and you have to achieve it. And so now I'm happy to say that, you know, I have written this book, and I think I've pulled out a lot of key lessons and tied it to my other work in business, in computer technology, and in spirituality.
The book is great, Riz, and it's for people who are thoroughly familiar with this and for absolute beginners. It works for both. I love the lessons you've teased out of the Yogananda material. So let's go right to that, because a lot of listeners on this show are very interested in practice, and the practices that you suggest based on Yogananda are pretty darn good. Let's take one that I know is a favorite of yours and mine, which is following the clues. You wrote a book about this called, what's it called, the treasure trail?
Treasure box?
Treasure hunt. And it's what I would call chiromancy, following special moments of synchronicity and signs from the world, similar concept. So you talk about, you know, learning to follow the clues in life, and you relate this to Yogananda's teachings. So talk to us a little about what it means to you to follow the clues on the treasure hunt of this world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's an appropriate time to be using the analogy of the treasure hunt and synchronicity and guidance as clues to what we were meant to do, because we have, as you may know, the new Indiana Jones, the last Indiana Jones film coming out. And, you know, for me personally, I always use the analogy of an Indiana Jones film where there is a treasure that he's seeking. And wouldn't it be nice if he just had a map at the beginning that just showed exactly where the treasure was? Well, that's never the case. Usually he has to follow one clue, and that leads to another clue, and that leads to another clue. And sometimes in life, it's the same way. We get messages. Yogananda said that, you know, intuition is soul guidance and arises naturally in man when the mind is calm. And so, you know, he ties it a lot to being able to still the thoughts, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, I'm sure, in the definition of yoga. But the idea is that we can get a funny feeling, a hunch, a feeling in our bodies, a feeling of deja vu. So all of these, I think, are clues that are leading us, you know, in a specific direction. And if we follow that clue, we then get the next clue on the direction that we were meant to go. And I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I sold my last software company, and I wasn't really sure what to do next. And I had this thought out of nowhere, oh, wouldn't it be nice to return to the MIT Media Lab, even though I hadn't been there, you know, in ages, and certainly hadn't done anything formal with them. And I went on their website, and it was that kind of funny feeling that I recognized as a clue. And I went on their website to see if there was any program there that I might get involved with, and I didn't find anything. So I thought, well, perhaps this clue is you know, just a random thought. It's not really leading me anywhere. So I kind of put it out of my mind. And within a week or two, I got an email from an MIT professor whose office is in the Media Lab saying, hey, we'd really like to meet with you, and we'd like you to come out to MIT, and we'd like you to give a talk. And then that led to me running a program called Play Labs at MIT. And so, you know, if we follow these clues, they can lead us to the next stage in our lives, whatever that happens to be. They can be little clues. They can be big clues. And, of course, you know, the classic definition of synchronicity is when there's a causal connection between an inner thought and an outer thought. You know, as simple as thinking about someone and having them email you or call you the next day. And so, you know, Yogananda was very good at following his intuition. And he often, taught his students to do the same, and he would realize, okay, this is the next step, that I'm supposed to take. And sometimes, he would get into that state, and he would need to ask for help because he wasn't sure what the next step was. When he first came over from India, he was a very young Swami, and he was called to go to the Congress of World Religions in Boston and give a speech, and he rarely had given a speech at that point. In fact, he had never given one in English. And so, tying it back to the lesson that I talked about earlier, he had a vision while he was meditating of all these white faces, and he had never seen an American. So he took those to be American, and maybe there was something for him to do in the West. But he followed the clue, and then within a week or so, he got an actual invitation to come to Boston and speak. And he wasn't sure if he should do it, but he realized that it was also a task the universe had put in front of him, and so he followed the clues, and that led him here. So he got on the first boat after World War One from India, and there were all kinds of obstacles along the way. He didn't have the money, he didn't have a visa, they didn't have any seats or berths available, and eventually all of those melted away. And that's what happens with clues, is sometimes clues give us a direction, sometimes they give us the timing, sometimes they give us both. And so that's, that's an example of following the clues.
Yeah, I love the story of the young Swami getting on the boat to Boston without really being able to speak English and somehow getting through all the obstacles because he trusted the vision and he trusted his feelings about it. In Wisdom of a Yogi, you draw on your previous book, Treasure Hunt, to give some rules for following clues. Well, let me just review them briefly and see if you'd like to add to this summary, which is essentially your own summary from your books. If a clue comes unexpectedly, it's important. Number two, when a clue repeats itself, you should take it even more seriously. Number three, when obstacles crop up but then melt away after you make a decision, then you know the time is right. I particularly like the last one because now we're getting into the Stoic wisdom that the obstacle might be the way, the setback might be the opportunity. Do you want to riff on those three rules or add to them or expand them in some way?
Well, I think those are the important rules, for recognizing whether an intuition is a real intuition or it's just a random thought, because we all have random thoughts during the day. And, sometimes people tell me, well, should I just follow the clue immediately? Well, it depends how big the clue is and what it's asking you to do. A lot of my work is about bridging the left brain and the right brain. And if the right brain is the more intuitive side, the left brain is the more logical side, I like to say we can look for verification, that this is the right step that we're taking. Going back to the story of Yogananda, you can see he got the initial clue unexpectedly, right? He was expecting that he would stay where he was. He was running a boys' school in the Ranchi district in India, and it just came out of the blue, and yet he knew there was something to it. But he wasn't sure exactly, what form it would take. He knew it had something to do with going to America. He sometimes would have visions of buildings, like one on a mountain and one by an ocean. And those ended up being buildings that he eventually ended up building. And so, I do think it's important that we follow the thread, but we often get this red light, green light. So when he was on the boat coming to America, some folks asked him to give a speech. And as I said, he had never given a speech in English. And so, he was in front of this group of people, foreigners from his perspective, and all the notes he'd prepared went out of his brain, and he just kind of stood there for almost 10 minutes without saying a word, and then he issued a silent prayer. And so sometimes we can ask for either a clue or for help. And in his case, he saw a vision of his guru and heard him say, you can speak, and he started speaking very forcefully in English and gave this speech that everyone told him was a great speech, but he couldn't for the life of him remember what he had said afterwards. But it was sort of a confirmation of an obstacle that, it was a good way to get over the obstacle so that when he got here to Boston, he was ready to speak in English.
10 minutes is a lot of dead air. That must have been really a very, very edgy 10 minutes. I'm going to give you a quote from the autobiography. It's actually from his guru, Sri Yukteswar, and I think Yogananda has been quoted as saying this is his favorite passage in the whole book, and you know this. The, this is the word, these are the words of Sri Yukteswar, Yogananda's guru. Forget the past. The past lives of all men are dark with many shames. Human conduct is ever unreliable until anchored in the divine. Everything in the future will improve if you're making a spiritual effort now. I mean, this is good stuff, but what I wanted, the question I want to lead to is how Yogananda met his guru, because it becomes one of your lessons, basically, about the idea that what we're looking for might be at home or on the next block, because as I recall, he thought he'd have to go to the Himalayas or somewhere very difficult and far away to find the teacher he'd identified as the master he wanted to follow. Then he runs into Sri Yukteswar in the street, in the city where he's living or visiting, right? So, you know, the everydayness sometimes of the revelation.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, so that's correct. And so one of the lessons in the book is you don't have to go to the Himalayas. What you're looking for may be very close by. And so, you know, he had a vision when he was young of these yogis meditating, and he said, "Who are you?" And they said, "We are the yogis of the Himalayas." And somehow with that vision, he knew he wanted to be a monk. And, you know, sometimes we have a glimpse of our future that shows us the things we were meant to do, but we don't always have the specifics right. So he spent a lot of his childhood trying to run away from home, trying to go to the Himalayas and find a spiritual master and become this wandering monk. And, of course, he was too young to leave home. And so there are these very colorful stories where he's running away, including one in high school, where, you know, he gets on the train and his elder brother is chasing him and his friends all across northern India to try to fetch him. And he finally had to agree, you know, his father agreed that he would finish high school before going off to become a monk. And the point is that he spent all his time thinking he had to go up towards the Himalayas or elsewhere. And when he met Sri Yukteswar, it turns out he was only a few miles from Calcutta, which was the city that Yogananda was growing up in, that had been growing up in. And so it was, and turns out that Sri Yukteswar was a disciple of Lahiri Mahashaya, who also Yogananda's father was a disciple of. So they were, in a sense, you know, brother disciples of this guru. And so it ended up being much closer to home than he had expected. And that's often the case. And, you know, I mentioned Steve Jobs earlier, and when he was younger, he went all the way to India and ended up in this, you know, hostel room. And in that room, there was a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi. Right? He went all the way to India seeking enlightenment, but he brought this book back, and that was the book that he ended up reading every year and giving away at his funeral. And so this process continues to happen, and sometimes we just need to look around us. And in fact, you know, Yogananda collected all these stories of all these swamis that he had met and these miracles that they had performed right there in Calcutta. So the fact that he was constantly meeting, and anytime there was an interesting swami, he was running after them. And then he could recall those many years later was also turned out to be a part of his life path and his life mission, because he put those down and that became part of his book and his legacy.
We jumped into some of the stories and practices in a really exciting and happy way. Let's go back to one very basic thing before we have to take our first break, which is, you know, the foundation of it all, the foundation of yoga as presented by Yogananda and as popularized and brought to the people by you. The heart of that practice, I think you say, echoing Yogananda, is to calm or quell the whirlpools of thoughts and feelings every day. I mean, that is, and you need a simple everyday practice to do that. Is that on the mark? Is that the foundation of it all?
Yeah, very much. So, you know, today we think of yoga as being the asana or the physical postures. But Yogananda reminded us that, according to Patanjali, who was the sage who wrote the Yoga Sutra, that there are eight limbs of yoga. And the asanas, is just, the physical postures are just one of those limbs. But really, the definition of yoga, according to Patanjali, is very much the stilling of these storms of or whirlpools of thoughts and feelings and desires in the river of consciousness is how I like to define it, because if you think of a whirlpool, it has to be in some substrate, like a river or some water. And I think that, you know, that's the key. If you think of a snow globe and you shake up the snow globe, you can't really see what's in the scene. But if you just let all of those settle, then you can see very clearly. And anyone who's done, even physical yoga, knows at the end, the last posture you typically do is Shavasana, which is translated as either corpse pose or one I like better is peaceful pose. And you have this feeling of stillness, of letting it all settle down. And any practice that does that can be considered yoga. And it's not just my opinion, not only was Yogananda saying this, but, you know, Patanjali himself said this as well. And so whether it's meditation, concentration, you're doing Tai Chi, you're maybe taking a walk by the ocean, it calms these. Because it turns out these vrittis, they harden, right? So there is a storm of them. They harden as what are called samskaras or imperfections in our field, which are called kosas in the Sanskrit term. And those eventually turn into the vasanas, which are our tendencies across life. So basically the whole basis for karma, right, lies in these vrittis. And, you know, that is also what the Buddha was saying. When the Buddha said, that which is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Meaning, if you just stop creating more of these things, you will stop creating more karma. And that alone is the process which leads to enlightenment.
That's very helpful and very clear, Riz. We're talking to Riz Van Zurk. His new book, which I highly recommend, is Wisdom of a Yogi, subtitle Lessons for Modern Seekers from Autobiography of a Yogi. We have much more to explore. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Maas. We'll be back after a short break.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MaasDreams.com. At MaasDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Maas, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MaasDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MaasDreams.com.
Robert Maas has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MaasDreams.com. That's MaasDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
Listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Maas. Check out my website, maasdreams.com. I'm leading some new courses. We have wonderful guest, Riz Virk. His new book is Wisdom of a Yogi. Riz, I'm going to give a quote that you're very familiar with from Yogananda, and the origin of the quote I'd like to mention before I get to the words. As he tells the story, as I recall, you may remember it better. It's during the First World War. But he finds himself from a state of meditation inside the body, it seems, of a Royal Navy captain who's about to die and, in fact, is shot in the chest and killed. And he's in this life and in this death and very vividly. And as he comes back, he's not sure who he is. Is he the British naval officer or is he a young Swami? And suddenly it comes to him that it's all like a movie, and actually goes to the movies that night and watches the old-time newsreels of the war, and then they seem less real to him than his own impressions, and somehow, in a way which I must say I can't rationally understand, he reaches the understanding for him in his mind and heart that he expressed in this quotation. One's values are profoundly changed
when he is finally convinced that creation is only a vast motion picture, and that not in it, but beyond it, lies his own reality. So, of course, the movies were high-tech back in the 1920s, a century ago. Today we think of other things, as you teach us to do in your book, The Simulation Hypothesis, and its sequel about simulation in the multiverse. It's interesting to me that he could jump, I mean, as the yogi that he was, from an experience, a very realistic experience, of going through life and death in another body in the midst of a war, to saying, well, it's all a big picture show and the reality is behind it. Don't get so upset by anything that happens. It's an astonishing moment of understanding, interpretation, of choosing your reality. But let's jump to you and your simulation hypothesis. How would you put this idea, which I know you're sympathetic to, in today's language? The great picture show.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Yogananda, you know, as you mentioned, he was very much into the technology and science of his time. And it's one of the things that made him, what his biographer called the first modern yogi. And he often ruffled the feathers of some traditionalists in the way that he went about things. But this analogy, he loved this analogy, and he used it again and again, of being in a motion picture and looking at the light from the projector. And he said, you know, you are no more dying than the actors in a movie when their character dies. And that was the message that he got very strongly, that life and death are relativities that belong to the cosmic dream, and that there is a dreamless being. Well, I sincerely believe that if Lord Yogananda were alive today, he would use the technology of today, and he'd say, well, it's kind of like a movie. It's also kind of like a stage play, which is another analogy that has been used by the Vedas, with the Leela, or the divine play has been used by Shakespeare. But it's interactive, and you can change the script, and a bunch of us are playing together. Right, back in Shakespeare's time, the actors were called players. In fact, they still are to a certain extent. And we can change this movie. And so if you were to talk about that in today's language, you would say that basically we're inside an interactive, massively multiplayer video game, and that our characters are what we call avatars in the video game world. And, you know, some of your listeners will be familiar with the terminology in video games. Some may not be, but perhaps their kids are. Video games have become a big part of the entertainment industry. And so I reached the conclusion when I was playing a virtual reality ping pong game, and it was so real that it fooled my brain into thinking I was playing a real game of table tennis. And so much so that I tried to put the paddle down on the table, and I tried to lean against the table. But, of course, there was no table, and the game controller fell to the floor. And that's when I realized that we were getting very close to being able to create something like the Matrix ourselves. And then there's a whole branch of techno-philosophy that talks about this idea that if we can get there, then someone may have already gotten there, and so what we're seeing is a kind of illusion. And then I found this in, you know, not just, of course, in the Indian traditions, the word Maya means illusion. And what it really means, though, is a carefully crafted illusion. It's like if you're watching a magic show, you kind of suspend your disbelief so that you can enjoy the show. And that's kind of what we're doing here, is we're playing this game. And it turns out this, you know, these terms that are there in other religions, I'll be giving a talk about Islam and the simulation hypothesis, and there's a verse in the Quran that says we have set up this world as a play and a distraction, or as a sport and a pastime for you. In the same way, so the same idea that what you see is a delusion. And Yogananda used to emphasize that everything is built off of light, and that was how he tied that into the idea of miracles as well, because if everything is light, well, then those who are adept can create with light. It turns out in a video game, if you play it, that's really what we're doing. We're lighting up the pixels, and we're rendering the information into a scene that you can see and that you feel like you're actually in the world, the more immersive the game is. And so that's how Yogananda relates very much to the simulation hypothesis. And I do believe if he were alive today, he would use this analogy with people today to spread the message that the world is, in fact, an illusion of a type.
Thank you. When you use the word rendering, you throw my mind into thoughts that came to me when I was reading your simulation material about how the reality we inhabit is, might be only a partially rendered part of a, you know, much larger field of possibility where the rest of it isn't yet pixelated because we're not there. And I'm struggling with that language, but I'm not struggling with the images that came to me because I started thinking about a certain kind of dream in which I usually become lucid or am lucid. And I'm in a scene which is very vividly realized, and then I discover that it has limits. It sort of ends. That there's nothing beyond a certain point except a blur, or then perhaps it begins to fill in. But initially, the whole scene, richly populated and fully realized though it is, let us say, a rendering, a scene that is intact in itself, but doesn't go beyond these boundaries. The old TV series The Prisoner had something of this quality. You know, you can never get out of this particular environment. Might it be the afterlife, might be one of these places with boundaries and controls. So, of course, I'm moving crab-wise towards the statement that, to me, the most satisfactory model is not the picture show or the video game or even the theater. It is the dream, which comes up again and again, of course, in Yogananda. And I was noticing in Sri Yukteswar's seminar on the astral reality delivered from the afterlife in a glow of light in the Regent Hotel in Bombay, as it then was, in 1936. And I'm going to ask you to speculate with me about what was going on with that astral geography in the next segment. But these analogies are very rich. I don't know that it's automatic for me. This is still mystifying to me. The vivid experience of being shot in the chest in a Royal Naval officer's uniform and coming back and being confused about what is what, to saying, well, it's all a picture show and it doesn't exactly matter because the reality is somewhere else. That was a leap of understanding that I would find it hard to emulate, at least on the day when I had that powerful vision. We'll have to pause here. We're talking to Rizwan Virk. His excellent new book is Wisdom of a Yogi. We'll be back to explore many other possibilities involving reality, illusion, dreaming, and how to apply the great discoveries of a yogi writing and practicing 100 years ago to our contemporary lives. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. We're talking to Riz Virk. His new book, Wisdom of a Yogi, is well worth reading and applying. Lessons, tips for your life that will bring in
the recognition of deeper worlds in ways that have good practical outcomes. I want to talk to Riz about my favorite chapter in the autobiography of a yogi, the autobiography of Paramahansa Yogananda, on which he based his lessons for seekers today, which is chapter 43. It's not a major part of this book, Riz, but I want to talk to you about it. Let me just set up the thing a little bit. Sri Yukteswar is on his way to death, and there's actually a very moving scene where Yogananda reports that his guru, who must be prepared for death by all his practices, but must really not, in our terms, have much fear of death, actually trembles like a child. And he quotes Patanjali on how even the most evolved can be nervous about going into a new environment. And there's a phrase there about how the caged bird is frightened when the door is left open. And then, you know, Yukteswar has died, and there is Yogananda sitting in his room on the third floor of the Regent Hotel in Bombay, as it then was in 1936 in June. He has a vision of a golden glow rising across the street and becomes Krishna, and of course he does the appropriate things. Then a week later, there's another golden glow right in the room, and there is Sri Yukteswar looking absolutely as he did in life. He seems to be in a flesh and blood body. And the guru said that the dead guru, now very much alive, says, I am resurrected. Here I am. Yes, it is a real body. And proceeds to give Yogananda a really wonderful astral geography, astral physics, account of, you know, what goes on in the astral body and how many countless levels of the astral there are and what is the causal plane beyond the astral plane and how you might graduate from that. It is actually, in 20 or 25 pages, one of the better accounts of transition zones on the other side of death that I know. And there it is, all being delivered by the dead guru to Yogananda in his hotel room. What's your opinion about that chapter? What does it do for you?
Well, it's an interesting chapter because it, you know, ties into Yogananda's own life, and you know, he had a tendency to want to avoid or to not be there when some of his loved ones died. You know, when his brother died, he was off in Japan. And when his mother died, he and his father weren't there, and that was a major, major influence on him and kind of shaped his life very much by looking for the Divine Mother. And, of course, his guru, he ended up going to a Kumbh Mela, which is this big giant spiritual festival they have in India every 12 years or so. And that was the time when Yukteswar chose to be gone. But, you know, when Yukteswar came back, he was sort of amused that Yogananda was shocked that he was there after he had died. And he has this quote that I really like, which, you were only dreaming on earth. On that earth, you saw my dream body. Later, you buried that dream in an image. Now my finer fleshly body, which you behold and are even now embracing rather closely, is resurrected. Now, this is not the first time in the autobiography where he shows a being materialized who's not actually there. Perhaps this is the first time someone who's died, but in fact there's another chapter where he talks about getting a message from Sri Yukteswar that he was not going to be there on the morning train. He's going to be there on the next train. And his roommate, I forget his name now, but he couldn't see Sri Yukteswar, but Yogananda could. And so his roommate went off to, you know, the train station at the original time he was supposed to arrive. Then he came back and he was angry. But during that time, Yogananda saw Yukteswar in the dorm room. And then he said, are you really here, or is this just a message you're sending? And he said, it is rare, but I've been granted this ability to actually manifest a physical body here. Yogananda says he touched his feet and his robe, and he felt it, even though he wasn't there. He was, you know, coming on a train from another city. And so this idea of materialization of bodies is something that happens, you know, a number of times within different stories. And so this, what to me was a very, very interesting chapter because, you know, first time I read it, and a lot of the miracles that happen in Yogananda's book, I always found very colorful and interesting, and yet even this one, you know, made me think, oh, is this, you know, did this really happen, right? I think we ask ourselves that.
I don't have that tick, that pause of skepticism in relation to either this or the train story you're telling. We'll come to the miracle stories later. You write very well about those. This business of what the Victorian psychic researchers call phantasms of the living, as in your story of what happened with the train, this has been observed and written about, you know, for a very long time. One of my favorite areas of private research is all the psychical research, as they called it, went on in Victorian times in England and to some extent in the United States and France also. And the first great research project of the Society for Psychical Research in London was a vast two-volume collection of data called Phantasms of the Living. And it's basically devoted to things like bilocation, someone turning up who might be a ghost but is in fact a second body, an apparitional body of a living person. And they're trying to bring all the rigor of science as they know it, nailing down these accounts and making sure that they are for real. I mean, there's nothing New Agey or even particularly spiritualist about them. So when you tell me the story of the second person in the train, well, adepts have always been attributed such powers, as you know. In any religious or spiritual tradition that I know about, adepts are supposed to be able to travel around outside the body, as of course all of us do in dreams any night, but actually to project a substantial seeming second body and do things with it. But the study of that is a long-standing thing, but the practice of it is probably more important. Let's just move on briefly, because it's such fun. So the really wild miracle stories in autobiography of the yogi, which is probably what gave it its popularity in the early days. Some of these are the material for the Marvel, you know, cinematic multiverse, aren't they? You know, the Tiger Tamer and other things. And some of these, you know, make rather adolescent, immature people think, oh, I'll go and develop some CDs by doing a certain practice, by sitting on a mat for a while, and then suddenly I'll be able to do these things that the great yogi can do. You write very well about these wonder tales, these miracle tales in the autobiography, why they're included, and what effect they have on the reader, and what relationship they have to reality. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, first of all, just going back to the story, yeah, there are quite a few stories of the bilocation, and what's interesting is, you know, they appear in a lot of different traditions, particularly when you see a projection of the body. But in these two stories, what made them unique from other bilocation stories, at least as far as I know, within, you know, certain traditions, is Yogananda was able to feel the robe and touch the feet, and it was a physical manifestation versus, I guess, what would be like a projection there. And so, you know, I don't, within the West, that tends to generate a lot of skepticism and is one of these miracles, as they're called, you know, play a big role in Yogananda's autobiography. And, you know, he had to convince a Western audience that yoga was a real tradition, and he wasn't above using tricks and techniques in his talks. Instead of talking about spirituality, he would talk about the science of religion and how to build strength in your mind, how to achieve success, and being more practical. And so, you know, there was definitely a bit of a showman in him. And so I think he included these stories partly for that reason, but that doesn't mean that they didn't happen. And Yogananda goes through great lengths sometimes to show us the provenance of some of these things which either he saw himself or his guru, who he trusted implicitly, saw, or, you know, to provide details of who exactly saw what where, for what I'm sure he knew would be a bit of a skeptical audience. And today we call these things superpowers, as you said, and they make their way into superhero stories in the Marvel and the DC universe, for example. But I think that these stories give the autobiography a lot of its color and make it a very colorful and a very memorable book.
Oh, it's a good read. It's a page turner. We're talking to Rizwan Zirk, whose own riff on the autobiography of yoga, of a yogi, Wisdom of a Yogi, is out. And we'll be back to look at more of how we can apply the lessons to our everyday lives after the break.
Yeah. Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss, Rizwan Zirk. The Wisdom of a Yogi, Lessons for Modern Seekers from Autobiography of a Yogi, the book, famous book by Paramahansa Yogananda, that did a lot to bring yoga to the West. And Riz, I want to ground this now again in the road to the everyday life, how we apply the lessons. I'm looking at some of the things you encourage us to learn and remember from the study of Yogananda. One of them is, You enjoin us to make time for little pilgrimages, that's your phrase, to places where we feel close to heaven and earth. I see you've just been traveling a bit around this country. Talk to us about making little pilgrimages as a practice for everyday life.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a lesson that really came to me both from Yogananda's book and from his life. And, you know, he would end up, wherever he went, he would take time, you know, to go visit a particular temple in that city, and he would tell a story from those. And, you know, he was a strong believer that these places made it easier to get in touch, either with the divine or with certain energies. So, you know, when I was young, you know, we always talked about a pilgrimage being like a big pilgrimage to Mecca, which most Muslims are supposed to do once in their life. But in Yogananda's case, he was always doing these little pilgrimages to go to these various places. And there's a lot of great stories, you know, from the autobiography where he would go to a temple. In one case, his sister and her husband, who was very skeptical of yoga, right? He was like, why are you dressing in these filthy robes to be a yogi? Why don't you get a real job so you can support a family and become, like, you know, a respectable person in the modern world? And, you know, she was sort of at wit's end because she was spiritual, like Yogananda, whose given name was Mukunda. And so they invited Satish, her husband, to go with them to this temple of Kali outside of Calcutta. And, you know, there Yogananda spent his time meditating. And he was meditating not just on the Divine Mother, but on how he could help his brother-in-law to realize that there is a spiritual component to life. And it turns out that they hadn't arranged for lunch, and the brother-in-law got very mad at him. He said, you little fool, you just sat there and you meditated the whole time, and now we're not going to be able to have any lunch because they only give you lunch here if you prearrange it beforehand. And so he was really angry, and then what happened was another monk came out who saw Yogananda meditating, and he said, I saw that you were meditating, I saw that you're a spiritual person, and therefore we have arranged this lunch for you. And that, you know, it's not about, the story wasn't about the lunch. It was both about going to a spiritual place, making the time, and also meditating in that place. But also that ended up surprising Satish, his brother-in-law, so much that he ended up changing his entire perspective. And so it was a solution to a problem as well. And I think, you know, we can go on pilgrimages in many different places, whether it's little places around us that are in nature that make us feel a certain way. And while I was writing this book, when I was just getting started, I was looking for inspiration, and I wanted to go to where Yogananda wrote this book, which was the seaside hermitage in Encinitas, just outside of San Diego. And there's a big hermitage overlooking the Pacific Ocean, and he spent the last decade or two of his life in that place, and much of it writing this autobiography, which would become his legacy. But the problem was, it was during COVID, and they had closed it off to the public. Well, it turns out that, when I talked to the SRF, the folks who run from Yogananda's organization, they were able to arrange for a private visit for me. And so for me, that was a real pleasure and a treat, but it was a meaningful pilgrimage because here I was writing a book about Yogananda, and I was able to go into his office, with this beautiful view of the ocean, where he did a lot of the actual writing. And while I was there, I did what Yogananda would do in many of these places, and I meditated and closed my eyes. And it turned out I ended up having a vision of him while I was there. And it was relatively, unexpected, and I saw him in his robe, and he was looking at me, and he had a stack of papers, which I took to mean, his book, in the old way before computers. And, so I was sort of seeing this in my mind's eye, and suddenly he opened the door to the Pacific Ocean, and to my horror as a writer, he took the papers and he flung them out towards the ocean, and they like flew everywhere. And I was like, oh no, you're going to lose it. What's going on? And then suddenly all of the papers turned into little white birds, which flew off in different directions. And he smiled at me. And that was a message for me as a writer that I wouldn't have gotten, but I got it because I happened to be in a particular place where a saint like Yogananda lived. And for me, the message was, your writing will be there to deliver this message and carry it to many different places, and it's okay to let it go and see where it ends up. But it was a very powerful experience for me.
And I love it. I love it.
The message is go out of your way.
I have dreams and visions of writers, of course. The recent one that came to mind, it was in my house, not at the place where he functioned. I'd probably have to go to England to do that. He didn't travel outside England very much. I dreamed earlier this year that Tolkien and his wife stayed overnight at my place, Ruth. I like Tolkien. I read a lot of Tolkien. Tolkien was more of a dreamer than most people know, and it's not reflected in the movies, and it's not all that important in Lord of the Rings. But he was a dreamer. He dreamed philology. He dreamed ancient languages. He dreamed of Atlantis and the big wave. Anyway, so there's Tolkien, and I like Tolkien. And in the morning, in my dream, we have a long conversation about what different mythic traditions we're both familiar with and the ones that I've studied that he doesn't know so well, like North American, indigenous traditions and so on, Australian. And he's encouraging me to write in a certain way. Then his wife, Edith, about whom I didn't know very much, appears. He's in a bathrobe, by the way. It's all very realistic. And he says, and he and Edith say together, we have a cottage in the woods. We'd like to offer it to you as a place to go and write. I come out of the dream. I mean, tremendously excited, and I make a drawing, I make a picture, I like to sketch and paint my dreams, Tolkien and Edith, encouraging me to go to the cottage in the woods, but really, I don't know where the cottage is. I don't think I can get there. I don't think it's available. I checked out the real estate in England relating to the Tolkien family, and I couldn't possibly afford to buy the places that they lived in, even though they were fairly modest by the standards of their day. So I don't have white birds flying over the ocean or the place where he was.
But Robert, do you know that there was a group set up in Oxford, as a fantasy kind of writing group that was trying to purchase his home and turn it into a retreat for writers. And I'm actually going next week to a workshop that they're holding in Oxford. It's not in his house. It's actually at Oxford. I don't know if they actually ended up buying it or not. So that was a really interesting story and an interesting synchronicity.
Well, then there must be a very, very good, if crazy, reason why I decided to tell you that story in a show devoted to you and Yogananda. We'll have to see where things lead now, won't we?
Absolutely.
Always worth following that flash of intuition, that flash of inspiration. What is it like talking to you, Riz? We're going to come back in a moment really just to say dream on. I know that your book, Wisdom of a Yogi, is doing well. I'm told that you can't get across Delhi Airport without meeting it many times, which is great tribute to be so popular in India. Now you're becoming very popular in the United States, and I just posted a review of Wisdom of the Yogi on the Amazon site, so you've got that small tribute for you as well. So we've been talking to Rizwan Zirk, wonderful, lively, conversation full of stories, which is what I always love. His new book is Wisdom of a Yogi. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Maas. We'll be back briefly after the break.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Maas's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@maasdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, maasdreams.com.
Robert Maas has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit MaasDreams.com. That's MaasDreams.com. MaasDreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
We've had great fun talking with Riz Zirk about all the stories of Yogananda and how to apply in life the wisdom of a yogi. Thanks so much for joining us, Riz.
Thanks so much for having me on again. Really enjoyed it.
Okay, dream on to everybody listening. May your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.